This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Reconciling the official historical record with personal memory demands careful attention to detail. A pair of exhibits on file at the Life of North Carolina's Textile Mills offers students of history a chance to see where the official and the personal intertwine and diverge. The North Carolina Museum of History has mounted an exhibit that includes the photography of Lewis Hine. His stark black and white prints paint a vivid picture of young people, sometimes not yet teenagers, covered in lint and grime of the state's textile mills. Hine took those photographs between 1908 and 1918. He used them in his crusade for tougher child labor laws and enforcement. Meanwhile, UNC Greensboro public history students have created an online project called Community Threads, Remembering the Cone Mill Villages. Former residents of Greensboro's Cone Mill Villages have contributed photos and memories in writing and in audio that portray a gentler, more congenial life in the Greensboro mill communities of the mid-20th century. Benjamin Fallin guides the Community Threads project. He's going to speak at the North Carolina Museum of History next week. Today, though, he's with us in the studio, and with us as well, history graduate students Dale Pennington and Sarah McNulty. Benjamin, Dale, and Sarah, welcome to the program. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Now, what are the differences between the personal histories you collected, Benjamin, as part of the Community Threads Project and the photos that Lewis Hine took?
Well, I think there are a few differences. As you say, the Lewis Hine photographs, to our eyes, are very stark, and Hine himself saw them that way. He was trying to make a point. He was a reformer, and he was decrying the child labor and the conditions in which these kids were working. We were coming from a different point of view. First off, several generations later, my graduate students and I interviewed several dozen former mill villagers, and we were trying to figure out what this life meant to them, what it was like to live in a mill village, what their memories were, and how, looking back, they saw themselves and saw their place in history. We were really trying to offer an outlet for voices that haven't been heard in North Carolina very much, considering how central textile mill life has been to this state's history.
And Dale, you worked on both. You worked on the photo exhibit, and then you did the oral histories. When you went to do, did you see the photos first?
No, I actually did the oral histories first.
So then what was it like for you to see those photos over and against the stories that you heard? Compare that experience.
Well, it's very different because a lot of our oral history interviews were very nostalgic. And they talked a lot about the strong sense of community with the Cone Mill villages. And then you see the photos are very graphic at some points. And there's very young children working in the mills.
Sarah, were the people you talked with, did they work in the mills themselves?
Most of our interviewees actually were more second and third generation mill villagers. They were people who were born and for most part raised in the mill villages, but they themselves typically never worked in the mills, or if they did, for a very short amount of time, usually in between getting married or graduating high school. But most of the time, these people were people who left the mill village.
So they're reflecting mostly life in the village rather than life in the mill, which
exactly
might have been a little bit different. Tell us about, you talked to someone named Leroy Paris, and we're going to listen to him tell a story about the mill whistle, but would you tell us first about Leroy?
Sure. Leroy Paris is pretty much a normal mill villager that we talked to. He was born and raised. His father worked in the mills his entire life. He's actually really interesting in that a lot of mill villagers intermarried. So he married another mill villager who she was kind of atypical, as her parents did not work in the mills. Her father was the minister at Revolution Baptist Church. So they were part of the mill village, but not. But he grew up there, and they eventually got married after high school. And he eventually left the mill villages and worked in Greensboro as a drafter.
Well, one of the very important sights and sounds at least, in the mill village, of course, is the whistle that brought everybody to work. And Leroy Paris tells a story about that.
The whistles at the mills blew at shift change. In White Oak, they would blow the whistle at 15 minutes till. So people knew to leave home. They could probably nobody live farther than 15 minutes away. The man's responsibility to blow that whistle fell asleep. But he woke up at 4:45 and not 6:45. And he glanced at the clock and jumped up and blew the whistle. Well, people out in the village, they didn't have alarm clocks and stuff. Well, I guess they may have had manual alarm clocks back in those days, but they realized a lot of them wasn't all that dependable, so they heard the whistle blow, and they got out of bed and scrambled to get their clothes on and come running to work.
Here we go. Leroy Paris, he's part of the Community Threads Project, which is run out of UNC Greensboro. Benjamin Filin is overseeing that project. It does paint a picture now. Everybody getting up at the same time to the same whistle in a community, that is a closed community.
Right. That was one of the things that was the most striking, was what a strong sense of identity and community the people living there had. And that's really one of the main things that the people we talked to wanted remembered. I think historians have often focused on whether the workers were duped into this life, whether they were exploited, why didn't they join labor unions? All of those are legitimate questions, and no doubt there were dramatic power disparities in this relationship between the mill owners and the mill workers. But a separate question is, what did it mean to the people who lived and worked there? And the people we talked to feel, I think, that they want their lives recognized for the contributions they made to the economy, and also to feel that their own lives, their own childhoods, were legitimate sources of pleasure and stability in their lives, because it was the kind of community where everyone knew everybody. It's just sort of a cliche, but in this case, it really was true, and that whistle story illustrates that. Everyone was on the same clock.
Dale, did you grow up in a community anything like this? I'm wondering how different these stories are from your own upbringing and experience.
Well, I actually grew up in Greensboro. I would say, no, I did not have such a close-knit community where I grew up, but it's interesting because growing up in Greensboro, I had never heard of the Cone Mills or the Villages. So it was a very different experience learning about how close of a community existed there for so many years.
And close, and of course, their futures and their stakes, the stakes in everything in the community are pretty closely intertwined, which brings us to the story of Richard Owens. And we should listen to that story now. Richard Owens had a problem with chipmunks and a solution.
At one time, we had chipmunks that dug these little holes all over my grandmother's yard. So she gave my grandfather an ultimatum, which she could do very well. And she wanted those holes filled up. She wanted grass, she wanted flowers, and no chipmunk hole. So he tried everything he tried. He knew how to try. He put dirt in the holes. He dropped rocks down in it, put firecrackers in it, nothing worked. 2-3 days later, the chipmunks have got the hole back again. Finally, someone suggested, says, well, Rass, what you need to do is get you just a little can of gasoline, pour it down in that hole, and that'll run the chipmunks out. So he did. He got a 5-gallon bucket of can of gasoline and poured it down in those holes, struck a match to it. Well, half the mill village started vibrating, and the manholes out in the middle of 16th Street, half a block away, are flying up in the air from the explosion of the gasoline going off to get rid of the chipmunks. But I think that did get rid of the chipmunks.
Richard Owens explaining how his grandfather got rid of the chipmunks. That and many other stories are online as part of the Community Threads Project, Remembering the Cone Mill Villages, a project out of UNC Greensboro. Sarah, what's the importance of that story? I mean, why have a story like that online for all of us to hear? Why is that important?
Well, besides the fact that it's just a funny story, we love these kind of anecdotal memories of the Mill Villages because it really paints a picture of this community that even though they may have not lived in the best economic conditions and that, you know, they were by no means rich or well off, they had this really tight-knit sense of community, and they had a fun life, and they really enjoyed growing up. And these stories have been passed on. They continue. They still have these reunions every couple of years where I'm sure these stories continue to go around. And it just really paints a picture of a place that's a unique area, especially in North Carolina and in Greensboro.
And Benjamin, you know, when you talk about these sometimes culture wars, when we talk about the life of the mill villagers, the mill workers, and if you focus on that, what that would tell you about working in the South about labor unions and all of that. Then you look at the people who own their own houses and they're up from poverty, and maybe they had a much worse condition if they came from the hills where farming was hard. If you don't put those two things together, it seems to me, that's when you have a problem interpreting history. If you only look at one side, or if you look at the other, you say, well, they all own their own homes and everything was fine. Why would they want a union? Well, there's pretty good reasons for that too. But,
right.
But it seems to me that what you're saying is those stories have to be put together if you're going to make any sense of history, and if you're going to come up with a nuanced understanding of where to go from here.
Right, and they're not; those stories are not necessarily at odds. That they were in a tight-knit community and in a very dependent situation. I mean, really, it was the company that owned those houses. It was the company that ran the community centers, and that their entire livelihood depended on these jobs. And if you fast forward, as those jobs began to disappear, a lot of people's livelihoods really began to suffer, as we all know. At the same time, those people were there largely by choice. They had come there, if you go back to the turn of the 20th century, come there to escape a life of rural poverty. And so the stability of being in a home, even if it's a home without running water, was something that they treasured. A refrain that we heard over and over was, we didn't know we were poor. And I think that's a really useful encapsulation of this, because looking back, they would all agree, I think, that they were poor. But the "we didn't know we were poor" part also speaks to the sense of feeling in control of their own lives, feeling a sense of stability, community, and identity. We're very indebted to people like Paul and Judith Sams, who were former mill villagers, who single-handedly, I would say, well, they've had some help, but a lot of people have helped them to preserve these memories and stage these reunions that hundreds and hundreds of people come back to, junior high school reunions from the mill villages, even 40, 50 years later.
And the mill owners were very careful to pay attention to some of the things that would make it at least a stable environment. Mm-hmm. We have a story here from Jerry Riddle, who talks about receiving Christmas presents.
As a kid, I remember on Christmas morning, there's a big truck come down the street, and guys on the back would jump off and lay a smoked ham on everybody's front porch. That was Christmas morning. So we always had a nice meal on Christmas Day. And the schools, Combs ran the schools too. And they were, I remember as a kid, the little boys got a metal toy, usually a little airplane or a car or something like that. And the girls always got a doll, and we all got a bag of nuts and fruits and candy.
Dale, were there surprises for you along the way as you did these interviews?
Absolutely. Especially when you compare a lot of these anecdotes, like this one we just listened to, and the strong sense of community that the Cones were really instrumental in fostering. In particular, during one of my oral history interviews, I had a man who told me about a map of the 48 states that the Cones gave him for Christmas when he was in the fifth grade, and he still holds that very, very dear to him.
What about you, Sarah?
There were a lot of surprises. I guess the fact that so many of these people still feel connected, even though many of them left, and that, you know, there are some people who still live in the community, still live in the house they grew up. But the fact that they still identify with their specific mill village. I was in proximity. I grew up in Revolution, and that they are different to them. They are completely different entities. If you lived in Revolution, you were completely different from someone who lived in Printworks, who lived in White Oak.
Benjamin, one of the good things about this is you do get this fuller, more nuanced picture of life. But the fear always is that you're not getting the whole story. I mean, we know that the 1929 strike in Gastonia, the 33 strike all throughout the East Coast, when those failed, people didn't talk about them. Famously, they would not tell their children. And so is there a fear that, in a sense, you're only going to get the good stories, you're not going to hear about the things that were more difficult for people?
Yeah, I think that's a legitimate concern. And I guess I have a couple answers to that. First off, we did get some mixed stories. I mean, I remember one about there's the famous nationwide strike of 1934. And we talked to someone who remembers that the National Guard was in the mill villages with rifles, making sure that nothing was going to get set off in these mill villages. So some of this did surface. I think you're right that a lot of that has faded from memory. And I think the response to that is to juxtapose sources, to look at a terrific book like a Family by Jacqueline Hall and Bob Korstad and Jim Malutis, look at the Lewis Hine exhibit that Robert Allen and now B.J. Davis and the North Carolina Museum of History have put together, and to see how these all together give you a richer portrait. What I'm doing here with this project and what the students have been so terrific about embracing is to say that you do get something rich by talking to people and just for the moment letting them be the expert because it's their lives and they know what they experienced and their memories count too. And I think that's the contribution of this small project.
You are history students, Dale and Sarah. How does this change, just being involved in this project, your understanding of what it means to study history?
This project really, for me, gave me a new source in oral histories, a new way of studying those sources. In addition to reading about people, you can actually talk to them. And sometimes we did hear stories that were at odds or different than what we had been reading about. But really, it's in those differences and in those tensions between these two stories that new evidence and new conclusions you can really gain from that.
And how do you do that, Sarah? That seems to be a tricky thing. Stories are so small in the grand scheme, they could really distort a picture if all you had was that one or two stories, you know, and events and circumstances and larger than life figures that history makes the stuff of. That's easier to manage. How do you balance those two? How do you come up with the sum of those and a clearer picture of what was going on?
Well, I think the most important thing for us as history students is to remember that the sources are important because they were, you know, they are in fact very primary. They live through this time and their memories are so important. But as researchers, we want to go and look at what we can find that's written down that comes from the other side. So in my personal experience, I've actually written a kind of a seminar paper. It's like a mini thesis we do at UNC Greensboro about the Black Mill Village, which is East White Oak. And it was a little bit more, it was obviously a segregated mill village, but they have a different sense of community. And so I went back and I looked at the documents to tell me what it was like compared to the white mill villages, and to see how Cone talked about themselves, and then to see how the workers and the residents themselves saw their lives, and to make sure that I put them both kind of in a juxtaposition to one another, because you can't just hear one side and you can't just decide that one person is right because they both were there at the same time.
Make you think differently about your own personal history?
Oh, definitely. Well, it makes me appreciate oral history all the more, and makes me want to use oral history and family members and just spread oral history around, because it is so important, and it's an easy way to really get history down for everyone to see in years to come.
How about you, Dale?
Absolutely. And oral history really has this ability to bridge what you read in a textbook with what people actually lived and what it was actually like to experience an event, and then put that within a larger context.
Benjamin, tell us about how we can find these oral histories online.
There's a website, conemillvillages.weebly.com. So conemillvillages, one word, .weebly, W-E-E-B-L-Y.com. And one of the great things about the web as a medium is that it enabled us to invite contributions from the mill villagers. And this has taken on a life of its own, both through this site and through Facebook, with people adding their own photos, commenting on photos, and having chat forum exchanges through the web.
Rich project. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Benjamin Filene is Associate Professor of History at UNC Greensboro and Director of the school's Public History Program. It's a public history. Graduate students are with us as well, Dale Pennington and Sarah McNulty. Next up on The State of Things, we'll talk about the latest at Burning Coal Theater. Stay tuned.